Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to start with some current events, what everyone's talking about this week. We're going to move into the Royals, check in on Hollywood, and of course, there's always plenty of politics, as well as the weekly Levin reports. We're going to start with current event. Astronomer CEO Andy Byron steps down following Coldplay Kiss Cam controversy. For a tech company scandal, the Coldplay concert Kiss Cam moment between astronomer CEO Andy Byron and HR lead Kristen Cabot seems fairly innocuous, but the software company has given both the temporary boot. This is by Eve Beatty on July 19th. In the grand scheme of tech company scandals, the astronomer Kiss Cam situation feels pretty lightweight. As far as we know, the cozy proximity of astronomer's then-CEO Andy Byron and then-head of HR Kristen Cabot at a Massachusetts Coldplay show is not a case of sexual harassment, unlike far less viral cases at places like Uber and Google. It wasn't an allegedly drug-fueled night that ended in a fatal fight between two tech founders, as was claimed after Cash App founder Bob Lee was slain. It wasn't even an alleged love triangle between the founder of the world's most popular search engine, the world's richest man, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s future running mate. That was Google's Sergey Brin, Elon Musk, and Nicole Shanahan. And yet, this is the one we can't look away from. The entire world has supplanted Gillette Stadium's Jumbotron. Perhaps that's why Astronomer claims it's taking a step that other companies, like Google, haven't. In 2013, the search giant had its own alleged adultery scandal when Brin, there he is again, split from then-wife and 23andMe founder Anne Wojcicki after an alleged affair with Amanda Rosenberg, then the marketing manager for flop product Google Glass. It's unclear if Rosenberg and Brin ever attended a Coldplay show together, but it's worth noting that the band's Milo Xyloto tour, which was likely ongoing during the alleged affair, was abruptly truncated. The fates intervened, perhaps, sparing the alleged couple from Chris Martin's onstage commentary when their juxtaposition was revealed. Oh, but what if it had? Would Martin's SEO drop? Would angry Waymos circle his way home, ever waiting for his guard to drop? Luckily for Martin, Astronomer has far less reach. The privately owned software company, which you've probably never heard of until now, closed $93 million in funding in May. That seems like a big investment until you think about how a company that allegedly helps Nazis send newsletters just secured significantly more. Given the recency of that funding round, it must have pained Astronomer's board to announce yesterday that the board of directors has initiated a formal investigation into this matter, and we will have additional details to share very shortly. In the brief statement, which doesn't use the words Coldplay, Kiss Cam, or reverse prom, the company writes, "Astronomer is committed to the values and culture that have guided us since our founding. Our leaders are expected to set the standard in both conduct and accountability." It also clarifies some claims that Byron and Cabot were at the concert with colleagues from Astronomer, who, some online pundits claimed, must have known about the alleged relationship. Alyssa Stoddard was not at the event, and no other employees were in the video, the company writes, and then debunks other claims that Byron had issued a lyric-laden apology. Andy Byron has not put out any statement, Astronomer writes. Reports saying otherwise are all incorrect. Byron might not have issued a statement, but he and Cabot have both been put on leave from the company. Co-founder and chief product officer Pete DeJoy is currently serving as interim CEO, given Andy Byron has been placed on leave, the company announced on X, and a move delayed due in part to Byron's slow resignation and exit package negotiations, Axios reports. According to the New York Post, his colleagues might not be sad to see him go. In the workplace, Byron allegedly has a reputation as an aggressive, sales-obsessed executive who can be toxic, the paper claims, quoting one source as saying, "Everybody's laughing their ass off, enjoying the hell out of what happened, and him getting exposed. Perhaps that's why none of us can stop thinking about this small, relatively inconsequential story. After all, who here hasn't wished for Jumbotron comeuppance for their own toxic boss?" Everyone is also talking about Jeffrey Epstein this week. This next headline, how Ghislaine Maxwell is riding the new Jeffrey Epstein wave. The British socialite, currently serving a 20-year prison sentence for facilitating her late ex-boyfriend's sexual abuse, is pleading her case amid fresh outcry over the broader saga. This is by Dan Adler on July 17th. After the Justice Department announced in a memo this month that no further disclosure would be appropriate or warranted in relation to its investigation of Jeffrey Epstein, several interested factions sprung into action. MAGA loyalists voiced their outrage over the anticlimax. Democrats, watching Donald Trump's coalition fray over scuttled conspiracy theories, called for transparency. And the family of Ghislaine Maxwell, in a statement issued on Tuesday, seemed to sense an opening. Our sister Ghislaine did not receive a fair trial, they wrote. The week prior, her brother Ian had proclaimed Ghislaine's innocence in an interview with The Spectator. The British socialite and Epstein ex has been fighting her 2021 conviction on charges of facilitating the late financier's sexual abuse. She is currently serving a 20-year sentence in a Tallahassee prison. Her lawyers claim in their appeal that a plea deal Epstein made with federal authorities in 2007, when he was sentenced to 18 months in prison for soliciting a child for prostitution, should have shielded her from prosecution as a co-conspirator. After DOJ attorneys urged the Supreme Court on Monday to reject the appeal, Maxwell's lawyer, David Oscar Marcus, responded by situating the case in the currents that have roiled the president as of late. I'd be surprised if President Trump knew his lawyers were asking the Supreme Court to let the government break a deal, Marcus said in his statement. He's the ultimate dealmaker, and I'm sure he'd agree that when the United States gives its word, it should keep it. With all the talk about who's being prosecuted and who isn't, he continued, it's especially unfair that Ghislaine Maxwell remains in prison based on a promise the government made and broke. Since the Epstein case exploded into the public consciousness in 2018, following the Miami Herald's reporting on his sweetheart deal made a decade prior, it has been surrounded at every turn by a shifting mix of legitimate intrigue and more ornate conspiracy. On Tuesday, Trump, among several efforts to quell MAGA outcry, waved away the importance of the Epstein files by claiming that they were concocted by Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and former FBI Director James Comey, whose daughter, Maureen Comey, as the closest Epstein watchers often note, was one of the lead prosecutors in the case against Maxwell and Epstein. Maureen Comey was fired from her role on Wednesday, instantly raising the temperature of the speculation. I was summarily fired via memo from Maine Justice that did not give a reason for my termination, Comey reportedly wrote in a memo to colleagues. In recent days, a sense has emerged from this miasma that Maxwell, in her unmatched proximity to Epstein, might step in and disclose where Trump and his cabinet couldn't or wouldn't. Let her have her voice, Lady Victoria Hervey, a British socialite and Mar-a-Lago regular, tells me, because right now everyone is so split on what's going on, and I think the only way to really deal with this situation, let her speak. Hervey is the daughter of the 6th Marquess of Bristol and initially connected with Maxwell in the 90s London party scene. Her boyfriend at the time, a restaurateur, knew Maxwell when she was an Oxford student. Hervey also dated Prince Andrew for a period, and in recent years, coinciding with her entree to Palm Beach circles, she's been an adamant social media defender of the disgraced royal and Maxwell. California was locked down, and a lot of people were spending time in Florida, she says. Obviously, I wanted to help find out more on this Jeffrey Epstein story. Hervey says she's been in touch with some of Maxwell's lawyers and family members and that she believed an effort to secure a pardon was in the works. I've met Kash Patel a couple of times, she tells me. I know a lot of people in the administration now. The anticipation surrounding Maxwell's next moves has been amplified by some of the most notable voices in the dense ecosystem of podcasts, newsletters, and influencers that has developed around the overall Epstein saga. I'm no political strategist, but Maxine is the only viable reset button. Jessica Reed Krauss, author of the popular politics and pop culture newsletter House in Habit, wrote this week, people don't trust politicians or media, but they'd show up to hear Ghislaine Maxwell speak. On Wednesday, Krause posted a photo of the comedian and podcaster Tim Dillon wearing a t-shirt reading Free Ghislaine while standing beside Alex Jones. As with so many Trump-era developments, the online discussion has quickly bled into national political discourse. We're intellectually consistent in this, House Speaker Mike Johnson said in an interview with conservative YouTube personality Benny Johnson this week. He had been asked if he would support Maxwell testifying before Congress or subpoenaing the Justice Department for the Epstein files, and offered a slight hedge. The speaker later voted against an effort to release the files and said his comments to Benny Johnson had been misinterpreted. "This isn't my lane. I haven't been involved in that," he told Benny Johnson, "but I agree with the sentiment that we need to put it out there." We are moving to the Hollywood section. Our first headline, Oscar season is on. Matthew McConaughey, Brendan Fraser, and a new Knives Out movie to hit the 2025 Toronto Film Festival. This is by David Canfield on July 16th. In the first of many fall festival program announcements to come over the next few weeks, the Toronto International Film Festival, acronym TIFF, has revealed its first wave of gala premieres and special presentation screenings featuring several Oscar-winning stars and a long list of award hopefuls for this coming season. The most notable announcement may be Chloe Zhao's Hamnet, in large part because the language used here indicates Toronto will not be the film's first stop. Her adaptation of Maggie O'Farrell's award-winning novel, which centers on William Shakespeare's wife, Agnes, will make its Canadian premiere at TIFF, a designation that typically implies that the film will first screen at both the Venice and Telluride festivals. A North American premiere at TIFF indicates that a film will first stop at Venice, while an international premiere signals a Telluride launch. That would make a significant show of confidence for a movie already trailed by a ton of hype. It's Zhao's first non-Marvel feature since Nomadland, which won Oscars for Best Picture and Director. And the ensemble is led by recently nominated rising stars Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. Yes, he's playing Mr. Shakespeare. Since the pandemic, TIFF has struggled to land as many glitzy world premieres as it did in its heyday. Last year, not a single Best Picture Oscar nominee launched in Toronto, a rarity, while its coveted People's Choice Award went to The Life of Chuck, which had a quiet U.S. theatrical release just last month via Neon. But the festival still screens the vast majority of fall awards players, even if many make other stops beforehand. And for this upcoming 50th edition, it's already firmed up some promising titles for world premieres. That list includes The Lost Bus, Paul Greengrass's new movie about the devastating wildfires in Paradise, California. This timely drama was produced by Oscar winner Jamie Lee Curtis and stars Oscar winner Matthew McConaughey. Other world premieres to keep an eye on include Searchlight's Rental Family, which stars Brendan Fraser, and recently locked down an awards-friendly November release date, and Netflix's Wake Up Dead Man, the latest Knives Out movie from writer-director Rian Johnson. The previous two films in the mystery franchise got Oscar nominations for their screenplays, and this edition features an incredible cast led by Josh O'Connor, Glenn Close, Kerry Washington, Andrew Scott, and Josh Brolin. And Daniel Craig, of course, returns as Detective Benoit Blanc. Netflix will stream the movie starting December 12th. Derek Chanfrance broke out in a major way with 2010's Blue Valentine, but struggled to gain much attraction with his starry follow-up The Place Beyond the Pines and The Light Between Oceans. So there's a lot of anticipation surrounding Roofman, his first feature in about a decade, and another TIFF world premiere. It stars Channing Tatum and Kirsten Dunst, and tells the wild true story of an Army Ranger turned McDonald's restaurant robber whose life of crime starts catching up with him. Paramount will release the movie in October. Other noted filmmakers set to launch their movies in Canada include Oscar nominee Agnieszka Holland, returning with Franz, a biopic of Franz Kafka, and hometown favorite Clement Virgo, whose Steal Away stars Anjuri Rice and Mallory Johnson. TIFF's 50th edition takes place from September 4th to 14th, with more lineup announcements to come next week, so stay tuned. Next is a review from a Netflix movie. Amy Bradley Is Missing breaks down a cruise ship nightmare. For decades, amateur sleuths and the FBI have tried to solve Amy Lynn Bradley's disappearance from a Royal Caribbean cruise ship. Can Netflix's latest true crime docuseries succeed where they failed? This is by Eve Beatty on July 18th. Between last month's train wreck, Poop Cruise, and new true crime docuseries, Amy Bradley Is Missing, Netflix appears to be doubling down on troubling tales from those floating pleasure palaces with buzzy results. Perhaps ABC should reconsider that Dr. Odyssey soft cancellation. Which is not to say that Amy Bradley Is Missing serves schadenfreude-adjacent fun like Poop Cruise or Odyssey. The three-part series, available to stream now, takes on a far more chilling narrative. In March of 1998, a 23-year-old Virginia woman named Amy Lynn Bradley stepped onto Rhapsody of the Seas, a Royal Caribbean international cruise ship headed to Curaçao. But her family trip with her parents and brother was cut short a few days later when staffers began searching the ship from top to bottom after her parents said she had vanished. She was gone, without a trace. This is where these kinds of stories typically end. According to a 2020 study from a Bowling Green State University, falls overboard or onto lower decks, cardiac incidents, and suicides are the leading cause of passenger deaths on cruise lines. Amy spent her last known night drinking until around 3:35 a.m. and fell asleep on her cabin's balcony as opposed to inside the cabin. This suggests the most obvious answer, that she stepped or stumbled into the water, is the true one. The twist is that after her disappearance, multiple people claimed that they encountered Amy, even years after she'd vanished. Three of them are interviewed in Amy Bradley Is Missing, where they recount, with sort of surprising detail, given that the exchange was decades ago, their encounters with the woman they believe to be Amy. The FBI investigated those accounts at the time, but was unable to confirm that the woman in any of the alleged encounters was actually her. Fuel was thrown onto the fire of speculation when the Bradley family was directed to photos on a website that advertised access to sex workers. One of the women in a set of grainy, revealing photos resembled Amy, the Bradleys said. The Bradleys spoke about the photos when they were featured on the November 17, 2005 episode of Dr. Phil. There, host Phil McGraw presented a so-called forensic evaluation of the photos as likely evidence that Amy was trafficked into sex work and had since been unable to escape. The series gave significant weight to this possibility, as well as to theories presented by multiple online sleuths. Speaking with The Hollywood Reporter, filmmakers Ari Mark and Phil Lott say they find many post-disappearance theories credible. In fact, says Mark, they entered into the show thinking, ooh, maybe we could find her. I really got convinced because the credibility element was there, he continued. And when the credibility element is there, we could say whatever we want. We could question things and judge everyone. But when you look somebody in the eye and ask them the hard question, you could tell if the answer is real. You could tell if their story is authentic. That's a bold claim when you read it on the page. It feels bolder after watching Amy Bradley Is Missing, as strangers who, bless their hearts, probably do hope Amy is alive recount, likely for the umpteenth time, the extremely brief interactions they had with a fairly unremarkable woman, young white American women while they were vacationing in the Caribbean. Do they believe they saw Amy? Perhaps. But does it mean they did? Unlikely. The visitor logs of a website about Amy's disappearance are also presented as evidence. It's a chilling reminder that nothing we do online is private, but claims that a user or users with a specific web address visited the site on certain dates doesn't feel like the ironclad proof that Amy is being held captive with unrestricted internet access. By the third episode of the show, it's unclear whether it's a gift or a curse for the Bradley family. Heartbreakingly, they keep Amy's Miata polished and in good working order so she can drive it when, not if, she returns. According to Mark, I had Amy's mother, Iva Bradley, calling me every day saying, "All of our eggs are in your basket. We're relying on you to find her." This suggests that the Bradleys may have participated in this project because they believed it might bring Amy back to them. It would be amazing, wonderful, a mitzvah if that happened. But the promise the series dangles also feels a little cruel. Then again, hope, no matter how unrealistic, might be the only thing keeping the Bradley family going. In the last few minutes of this series, Amy's younger brother, Ronald Brad Bradley, basically admits as much. He was asleep in the ship's cabin just steps away from Amy, where Amy was last seen when she disappeared, a position that's clearly haunted him in the 26 years since. "We all have this gut feeling that she's out there," he tells the camera. "The lack of closure or the not knowing allows us to continue to hope. So I actually prefer it that way, other than the finality of having an answer." Next up, we're checking in on the royals. Our next headline, inside the rapprochement meeting between King Charles and Prince Harry's press teams. The king and his younger son have had a rocky relationship for years, but last week, the pair's proxy had a summit over drinks. Harry's hope is that there will be another meeting, a source told Vanity Fair. This is by Katie Nichol on July 14th. A reconciliation between Prince Harry and King Charles might be in the cards. According to the Mail on Sunday, the King's head of communications, Tobin Andre, met with Harry's U.S.-based head of communications, Meredith Mains. Last week, Mains, who traveled from Los Angeles for the meeting, was also joined by Harry's U.K.-based spokesman, Liam Maguire, and there are hopes in both camps that a rapprochement could be reached. Sources close to the Duke of Sussex told Vanity Fair that Prince Harry asked for the meeting while Mains was in London to meet his UK-based staff. The meeting, an alfresco drink, which was captured by a photographer, took place just a stone's throw from Clarence House, his father's official London residence. While details of what was discussed at the meeting are not known, sources close to Harry say that the prince is hopeful that a progress can be made. Harry has publicly said he wants to repair his relationship with his father and is privately said to be hoping that his father might consider coming to the 2027 Invictus Games, which will take place in Birmingham. Harry has reportedly invited members of his family to the opening ceremony after being upset that they declined to attend the London service honoring 10 years of the Games in May 2024. Harry's hoping that things can be rectified. He really wants a relationship with his father. He wants to change the narrative and not have the family feud be the focus of most stories that are written about him, a source told Vanity Fair. There's also hope that this might be the slow burner leading up to the Invictus game. It's 2 years away, but it's going to take some time to change the narrative. Harry's hope is that there will be another meeting, although it depends on how things play out. In a May 2025 interview with the BBC, Harry revealed that his father was not taking his calls. Sources close to Charles say he wants a better relationship with his youngest son. "The king has been deeply saddened by what has happened, and if he can, he wants to sort things out with Harry," says one of Charles's closest friends. "It's his son, and he loves him despite some of the things that have been said and done. The door has always been left open for a rapprochement, but it does very much depend on Harry and whether Charles can trust him." The leak of the secret meeting to the Mail on Sunday is problematic, however. Harry's PR team has claimed that they did not share the details to the press. Sources close to the king say that the progress can only be made if details of private meetings and conversations are not leaked to the media. Harry has previously detailed conversations between him and his father and his brother Prince William in his explosive autobiography, Spare. In his recent interview with the BBC, he said he didn't know how long his father had left, which is said to have upset Charles and infuriated his closest advisors. Harry added that he would love a reconciliation with his family, but that the king won't speak to me because of security stuff. The Duke was referring to his high court battle with the Home Office after he lost his right to automatic police protection when he travels to the UK. Charles has only met Harry's two children with Meghan Markle, 6-year-old Prince Archie and 4-year-old Princess Lilibet, on a handful of occasions and is said to want to see more of his California-based family. And in other royal news, Queen Camilla celebrates her love of dogs with a gold and mother-of-pearl brooch. On Monday, the Queen returned to the animal shelter where she adopted her puppy, Molly, last February. This is by Andrea Verdejo on July 15th. Everyone knows the great love that the Windsors share for dogs. The late Queen Elizabeth had her corgis, which since her death have been cared for by her daughter-in-law, Sarah Ferguson, and King Charles and Queen Camilla are fond of Jack Russell Terriers. This Monday, Queen Camilla visited the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home shelter in London on the occasion of the inauguration of a new dog garden designed by the famous English horticulturalist Monty Don. There, she surprised with a stylistic detail perfect for the occasion, a fun brooch in the shape of a dog. The queen's accessory, which adorned her favorite blue dress by Fiona Clare, is from the French jewelry firm Van Cleef & Arpels. It is part of the 2017 Lucky Animals collection, which included other brooches in the shape of animals, such as horses, lions, squirrels, and owls. The model worn by Queen Camilla in particular was crafted from 18-karat gold, onyx, and a mother-of-pearl, and it's priced at $7,400. This is not the first time Camilla has used her accessories to nod to the charitable causes she supports and the events she attends. In September 2024, the Queen wore a brooch, also by Van Cleef & Arpels, in the shape of a ballerina during a visit to the English National Ballet at the Mulran Center for Dance in London. The Queen has served as patron of the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home charity since 2016 and has even adopted twice, first Bluebell in August 2011 and recently in February, Little Moli, a Jack Russell cross. The names of Moli, Bluebell, and Snuff, the Legato Romanallo of King Charles, appear in one of the gardens of the Battersea Shelter, along with that of Beth, the royal's beloved dog, who died in November 2024. Our next headline is going to segue into the politics section, the FIFA Club World Cup and the global sports spectacle in the age of Trump 2.0. Soccer's international governing body staged a halftime show that hinted at its cultural aspirations for next year's North America-hosted World Cup proper. The president made sure to intervene in the entertainment. This is by Dan Adler on July 14th. J Balvin, the Colombian singer, playing reggaeton, Tems performing the Afropop she cultivated in Nigeria, Doja Cat, the insistently outré American star in front of a global audience. There was something pleasingly haphazard about this mashup, all the more so for a surprise appearance by Coldplay tacked on to the end of the halftime show of the FIFA Club World Cup final on Sunday in New Jersey. Lead singer Chris Martin assembled the lineup in his capacity as an ambassador for Global Citizen, the anti-poverty nonprofit, and as sort of standard bearer for the ecumenical cooperative vision attached to the image of the international sports spectacle. Fireworks went off in front of the Manhattan skyline at MetLife Stadium. In the audience, FIFA president Gianni Infantino watched alongside Donald Trump. The final of the Club World Cup, a competition among international professional club teams, not to be confused with the country versus country format of the World Cup proper, is a prelude to the full-fledged event that will take place on the same grounds next year. Ahead of this most high-profile occasion, the two men have ratcheted up their public kinship, with Infantino accompanying Trump on a trip to the Middle East in May. FIFA recently opened an office in Trump Tower, and as Infantino marked the moment alongside Trump's son Eric and the retired Brazilian striker Ronaldo, he thanked the president, whom he described as a big fan of soccer. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article from vanityfair.com. We are segueing into politics with an article about Trump at the FIFA Club World Cup on Sunday. Let's continue. The duo were joined in their box by Trump cabinet members Pam Bondi, Sean Duffy, Kristi Noem, as well as Rupert Murdoch, Tom Brady, and Melania Trump. The show of force was of a piece with Trump's broader MO in his second administration, as he has courted sports audiences as a signal of his cultural acceptance. Earlier this year, he attended the Super Bowl and Daytona 500 and announced plans to host a UFC bout at the White House for the country's 250th anniversary. "Could a woman make your team, fellas?" Trump asked a befuddled-looking group of Juventus FC players during their June visit to the Oval Office. After Trump was convicted last year of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment he made to Stormy Daniels, he quickly rebounded by attending a UFC fight. There, he found full support in an audience that included the outfit CEO Dana White and leading comedian podcaster Theo Vaughn. While Infantino has embraced Trump, the president's standing among international soccer fans rests on far more treacherous ground, not least because of the made-for-TV quality of his trademark immigration raids. On social media, reports quickly circulated that boos had broken out when Trump appeared on the Jumbotron during the national anthem. Conservative sports media personality Clay Travis insisted that he had, in fact, been cheered. From my seat in a mostly soundproof press box, it was impossible to tell. When the match ended, with the London club Chelsea notching a decisive victory over Paris Saint-Germain, Trump headed down to the field. He and Infantino grasped the Club World Cup trophy and carried it over to the winners. As Chelsea's captain prepared to hoist the prize, Infantino began walking toward the side of the group and out of the central fray. Trump stayed where he was, joining the team as if he had suited up with them. It was, even a decade into the Trump political era, a fairly jarring display of showmanship. A few Chelsea players appeared confused, but as they launched into their celebration, no one pushed him aside. We are full into the politics section. Our next headline, Donald Trump sues the Wall Street Journal reporters, Rupert Murdoch, for $10 billion over fake Epstein letter. A sitting U.S. president filing a lawsuit against a news outlet over a story is an unprecedented move, according to First Amendment experts. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on July 19th. President Donald Trump on Friday sued media mogul Rupert Murdoch over the Wall Street Journal's recent investigative reporting that said Trump sent his then-friend Jeffrey Epstein a bawdy letter for Epstein's 50th birthday. It's the first time that Trump has targeted a media organization with legal action as a sitting president. The lawsuit, filed with the federal court in the Southern District of Florida, names Murdoch, his company News Corp, and its CEO Robert Thomas, the journal's publisher, Dow Jones & Company, and the two reporters who wrote the article published Thursday, Khadija Safdar and Joe Palazzolo. This is the latest escalation in Trump's legal battles with news outlets that he claims have been unfair to him. We have just filed a powerhouse lawsuit against everyone involved in publishing the false, malicious, defamatory, fake news, all in caps, article in the useless rag that is the Wall Street Journal, Trump wrote on Truth Social. This lawsuit is filed not only on behalf of your favorite president, me, he continued, but also in order to continue standing up for all Americans who will no longer tolerate the abusive wrongdoings of the fake news media. In a statement to CNBC, a Dow Jones spokesperson said, "We have full confidence in the rigor and accuracy of our reporting and will vigorously defend any lawsuit." The Thursday article in the Wall Street Journal details the leather-bound album of letters compiled by Ghislaine Maxwell to Epstein for his 50th birthday in 2003. In the album, according to documents reviewed by Wall Street Journal, is a bawdy letter bearing Trump's name. It contains several lines of typewritten text framed by the outline of a naked woman, Safdar and Palazzolo wrote, which appears to be hand-drawn with a heavy marker. A pair of small arcs denotes the woman's breasts, and the future president's signature is a squiggly Donald below her waist, mimicking pubic hair. In an interview with the Journal, Trump denied writing the letter or drawing the picture, saying that it was not him, that it was fake, and that it's a fake Wall Street Journal story. In that interview, he also said he would sue the Wall Street Journal just like I sued everyone else. The alleged album was reportedly assembled before Epstein was first arrested in 2006, after allegations became public that he was sexually abusing girls. In 2019, Epstein died in jail after he was arrested a second time and charged with sex trafficking conspiracy. The Journal's exclusive also reported that there was a letter accompanying the drawing, which was styled as an imaginary conversation between Trump and Epstein. The Journal reported that letter reading, voiceover, "There must be more to life than having everything," the note began. "Donald, yes, there is, but I won't tell you what it is. Jeffrey, nor will I, since I also know what it is. Donald, we have certain things in common, Jeffrey." Jeffrey, "Yes, we do, come to think of it." Donald, "Enigmas never aged. Age, have you noticed that?" Jeffrey, "As a matter of fact, it was clear to me the last time I saw you." Trump, "A pal is a wonderful thing. Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret." Shortly after that story was published, the president went on his social media site saying, "The Wall Street Journal printed a fake letter, supposedly to Epstein. These are not my words, not the way I talk. Also, I don't draw pictures. I told Rupert Murdoch it was a scam, that he shouldn't print this fake story. But," Trump continued, "he did, and now I'm going to sue his ass off and that of his third-rate newspaper." A day later, he followed through on that threat. The lawsuit claims that the journal's reporting will cause overwhelming financial and reputational harm to the president. The filing against those involved with the journal article came on the same day as Trump's lawsuit against journalist Bob Woodward and his publishing house Simon & Schuster was dismissed by a federal judge. Trump's relationship with Epstein has come under intense scrutiny lately after the Department of Justice wrote in a memo, filed July 7th, that they had no evidence implicating other people in Epstein's crimes and no evidence that he had been killed. On the campaign trail, Trump repeatedly questioned Epstein's death and vowed to declassify files related to the investigation. The president's otherwise deeply loyal MAGA base has been brought up in arms about how he and his attorney general, Pam Bondi, handled the Epstein files. In February, Bondi said she had Epstein's list on her desk. Many people close to Trump, including FBI Director Kash Patel and FBI Deputy Director Dan Bongino, have expressed disdain about how the investigation into Epstein was handled. Trump, on Thursday evening, asked Bondi to seek the release of any and all pertinent grand jury testimony around the Epstein investigation. The president's legal action against media organizations is unprecedented, and his latest move especially so. As far as I can tell, no sitting president has ever sued a reporter or media outlet or media executive for allegedly defaming him, First Amendment attorney Ted Boutros told CNN's Brian Stelter. When you have the presidential bully pulpit, you simply don't need to sue to get to the truth. Carl Tobias, a University of Richmond law professor, told Stelter that Trump and his allies continued attacks on the media, from his suit against Paramount to Congress rolling back $9 billion in public media funding and foreign aid, could have a chilling effect on news organizations. His attacks on the media, Tobias said, undermine the First Amendment by making the media and others more cautious in covering Trump, his administration, and other federal and state politicians. To win his claims of defamation, Trump must show the Murdoch-owned publication acted with actual malice, meaning they knew the reporting was false or acted with reckless disregard for the truth. Our next politics headline, Donald Trump loses his grip on the base. After years of fanning the Jeffrey Epstein conspiracy flames, Team Trump fails to deliver the goods. This is by Molly Jong Fast on July 15th. The Justice Department and the FBI released a memo last week concluding that no further disclosure would be appropriate or warranted regarding Jeffrey Epstein, the late financier and convicted sex offender, and acknowledged that there was no secret client list in the government's possession and that Epstein had killed himself. In a normal world, this announcement would not be newsmaking, but not game would be newsmaking, but not game-changing. But because of the flames of the Epstein conspiracy have long been fanned by MAGA world, including Donald Trump loyalists who now holding powerful positions in government, such as FBI Director Kash Patel and Deputy Director Dan Bongino, the memo fueled a meltdown the likes of which we haven't seen in a decade of Trump's political movement. Here was the Trump administration, which was supposed to put an end to the so-called deep state, telling a conspiracy-addled base to essentially trust the deep state. It's always been easy for Donald Trump and his allies to peddle conspiracy theories to explain away things like losing the 2020 election. Since winning the 2024 race, Team Trump seemed intent on giving the conspiracy crowd what it wanted and revealing how the government isn't filled with well-intentioned, if occasionally incompetent, bureaucrats, but members of a deep state cabal. Attorney General Pam Bondi intimated in a February Fox News interview that the Epstein client list was, quote, "sitting on my desk right now to review." And then days later, the White House invited 15 right-wing influencers to preview the Epstein files, phase one. As Bondi backtracked, suggesting she was referring to other documents, MAGA figures like Tucker Carlson sounded off. Bondi made a bunch of ludicrous claims on cable news shows that she couldn't back up, and this current outrage is the result. As the Epstein fires burned and MAGA world imploded, Trump appeared uncharacteristically bad at damage control. Trump is usually able to meet the base where it is and satiate the crowd. Now he was like a magician out of tricks. "What's going on with my boys, and in some cases, gals?" he asked on Truth Social. "They're all going after Attorney General Pam Bondi, who is doing a fantastic job," all in caps. "We're on one team, MAGA, and I don't like what's happening. We have a perfect administration, the talk of the world, and selfish people are trying to hurt it, all over a guy who never dies, Jeffrey Epstein." Trump, doing what he does, turned to another conspiracy theory to explain why the Epstein conspiracy fizzled out, writing that the files were written by Obama, crooked Hillary, Comey, Brennan, and the losers and criminals of the Biden administration who conned the world with the Russia, Russia, Russia hoax, 51 intelligence agents, the laptop from hell, and more. They created the Epstein files. Blaming Democrats, especially Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, can be expected from Trump, but it was sort of late into the news cycle for a pivot. Other Trump officials, like Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, defended the government's conclusions on X, writing that the suggestion by anyone that there was any daylight between the FBI and DOJ leadership on this memo's composition and release is patently false. Some in the right-wing media also backed up Trump. Turning Point USA's Charlie Kirk told his viewers, "I'm done talking about Epstein," adding, "I'm going to trust my friends in the government." But it's hard to close the book on Epstein after years of buildup. Epstein was found to have died by suicide in a New York prison cell in August 2019, 3 years into Trump's first term. The murkiness surrounding his death sparked conspiracies, as did elements of his life, which hit several MAGA conspiracy sweet spots. Epstein had ties to powerful men, including Bill Clinton and Trump himself, and faced charges of trafficking and abusing underage girls, which dovetailed with QAnon theories about a global sex ring run by elites. When MAHA merged with MAGA, the conspiratorial base expanded, adding in people believing that chemtrails exist, vaccines cause autism, and fluoride is dangerous. The problem with fanning the flames of conspiracy theories is that sooner or later the piper must be paid, and a dismissive, "nobody cares about Epstein" was not what the base wanted from its leader. The base came to Trump and elevated him to a near godlike figure because it wanted answers from him. Instead, he dismissed it. Even the folks at Trump's happy place, the curvy couch of Fox and Friends Weekend, warned of a ticking time bomb for the president. "You have to answer questions to the American people," said co-host Kevin Corkey. "Because absent that, this story won't die, and that's a distraction the president doesn't want." Meanwhile, over on the War Room podcast, host Steve Bannon went as far as to suggest the GOP could lose 10% of the MAGA movement over Epstein, resulting in a devastating midterm losses. And Natalie Winters, a War Room correspondent and Bannon protege, told the Times that people are really upset about the outright dismissal of it. Perhaps former Republican Governor Chris Christie said it best on the Sunday shows. "We cannot let the president off that easily. He benefited directly from it. He fueled it. He encouraged it. And he certainly didn't stop it." Trump didn't stop it when he could, and now there's a danger that Epstein could block out the sun and eclipse the man who promised to reveal all. We're going to turn to the first of the 11 reports this week. This headline, Supreme Court conservatives tell Trump he can destroy the Education Department as a treat. The decision will affect millions of Americans, and surprise, not in a good way. This is on July 15th. The conservative wing of the Supreme Court gave the middle finger to Congress, low-income families, student loan holders, children with disabilities, girls, students of color, LGBTQ+ individuals, and more on Monday, when it ruled that the Trump administration can go forward with its plan to dismantle the Department of Education, a move that was previously blocked by a lower court and will harm literally millions of Americans. In an unsigned order that did not explain the justices' thinking, probably because the "fuck you" was implied, the court's six conservatives, half of whom were appointed by Trump, reversed an injunction issued last May that had blocked some 1,400 DOE layoffs. The injunction, issued by Judge Myong Jun in Boston, called out Team Trump for cuts that would likely cripple the department. The administration has insisted that it wasn't shuttering the DOA, which would take an act of Congress, but simply streamlining things. But June called bullshit, writing in his order, "A department without enough employees to perform statutorily mandated functions is not a department at all. This court cannot be asked to cover its eyes while the department's employees are continuously fired and units are transferred out until the department becomes a shell of itself." In response to her conservative colleagues, Justice Sonia Sotomayor issued a sharply worded dissent on Monday, saying that when the executive publicly announces its intent to break the law and then executes on that promise, it is the judiciary's duty to check that lawlessness, not expedite it. Staying June's order, she wrote, will unleash untold harm, delaying or denying educational opportunities and leaving students to suffer from discrimination, sexual assault, and other civil rights violations without the federal resources Congress intended. While the case, which combines ones brought by 20 states, the District of Columbia, the American Federation of Teachers, two school districts, and other unions, will continue to move its way through the lower courts, Education Secretary Linda McMahon called Monday's ruling a significant win for students and families. What exactly did students and families win here? As Time notes, the effective dismantling of the Department of Education would be devastating on numerous fronts and affect millions of Americans. For starters, gutting the department would likely mean less Title I funding, which currently provides billions for school districts with a large number of low-income students. It may or may not surprise you to hear that Project 2025 called for Title I to be phased out over a decade, a move that Advancement Project Executive Director Judith Brown Deanis has warned would harm nearly 3 million children throughout the U.S. by exacerbating the gap between the haves and have-nots, causing further loss and resources and support. Children with disabilities would also be majorly affected, given that the DOE oversees the distribution of some $15 billion in grants that fund special education services, services that were used by 7.5 million children in 2023. While Trump has said he would move special needs programs under the Department of Health and Human Services, critics have said that department lacks the necessary education expertise. How about student loan holders? Not surprisingly, they'd be likely screwed too. Per Time magazine, experts have previously warned that the dismantling of the department could massively disrupt the student loan systems. Peter Granville, a fellow at progressive think tank the Century Foundation, told CBS News that nixing the department before outlining exact plans for student loans would be a recipe for chaos and frustration for millions of people who rely on the program. What about civil rights protections? With the Supreme Court ruling, the layoffs put on hold will continue, and the enforcement of civil rights in schools is likely to take a hit, which will mean marginalized persons like women, LGBTQ+ individuals, and students with disabilities could lack available recourse and protections, according to Galen Burroughs, Vice President for Education and Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. For decades, the agency has played an essential role in safeguarding the rights of students, especially girls, students with disabilities, LGBTQ+ youth, and students of color, Burroughs said in a statement. Without enough staff and resources, students will face more barriers to educational opportunity and have fewer places to turn to when their rights are violated. The damage inflicted by this decision will be felt for generations. Monday's ruling comes a week after the Supreme Court's conservatives issued a similar decision, allowing Trump to move forward with mass layoffs across federal agencies. Our next headline, news not bad enough for you? RFK Jr. is reportedly considering another presidential run. An event held by his super PAC has people talking. This is on July 16th. If you've ever looked at Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and thought, I like the work he's doing, undermining vaccines and otherwise putting millions of people's lives at risk, but I'd like to see it done on a bigger scale, today is your lucky day. According to a new report, Mr. Maha may be considering making another presidential run in 2028. Axios reports that Kennedy's super PAC co-hosted an organizing call for supporters and influencers last week, a move that has stirred speculations that he's positioning for a run at the White House in 2028. The Zoom call brought together hundreds of Kennedy's supporters and was aimed at energizing his grassroots Make America Healthy Again movement and discussing ways to build enthusiasm for the Health and Human Services Secretary. While a presidential campaign was not explicitly discussed, two people familiar with the matter told Axios that they came away from the event believing it was a step toward another campaign for Kennedy, whose long-shot run in 2024 wound up helping Donald Trump to victory. The call was reportedly led by Tony Lyons, the co-founder and co-chairman of the MAHA Super PAC, vaccine skeptic Robert Malone, and Kennedy advisor Stephanie Speer. According to Axios, it was Lyons' involvement that people saw as a sign that the PAC would help prepare a campaign and fundraising machine in waiting for Kennedy, to be ready if he chooses to run. How would Kennedy pitch himself to the American people during a second presidential shot at the White House? Well, while he would undoubtedly tout his war on synthetic food dyes, he could also run on helping usher in a record-breaking number of measles cases in the U.S. thanks to his dedication to undermining vaccines. His support for the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which will cause millions of people, many of whom are children, to lose health insurance. The National Cancer Institute cuts that experts warn will set this nation back dramatically in our ability to reduce death and suffering. The proposed near-total elimination of funding to the CDC's Chronic Disease Center, despite Kennedy's claims of being all about fighting chronic disease. It'll be tricky to fit it all onto a lawn sign, but surely he can come up with some kind of snappy slogan to summarize the above, or maybe just a photo of him dressed as the Grim Reaper would suffice. And our last Levin report, Gavin Newsom calls Trump a son of a bitch who should model better goddamn behavior. The California governor has told the president to think of the children. This is on July 15th. California Governor Gavin Newsom has never been mistaken for a fan of Donald Trump, but during a recent podcast, he made his feelings for the president extra clear, calling him a son of a bitch who sets a poor example for kids. Speaking about Trump's decision last month to deploy the National Guard to Los Angeles, Newsom said on the Sean Ryan show, "They're sitting there on horses with American flags, running through soccer fields, scaring kids in the middle of the day at a summer camp. For what? Just toughness. It's a weakness masquerading as strength." Commenting on the ICE raids that have terrified immigrant communities in LA, Newsom continued, "That's what I don't like about this son of a bitch. He calls me new scum. How do I explain that to my kid? Now I have my kids' friends calling my kids new scum. That I get because I was called that in seventh grade, but not by a 79-year-old. He added that the president should model better goddamn behavior. Trump is not the only administration official Newsom had the words for of late. On Saturday, he called out Vice President J.D. Vance, writing on X, "J.D. is back in California. He won't take the time to debate and defend gutting our Medicaid system, taking away kids' school meals, militarizing America's streets, or adding trillions to the debt. Instead, he's off to Disneyland, probably to detain Mickey Mouse at this rate." In another post that day, the governor responded to a video of the VP and his family at Disneyland saying, "Hope you enjoy your family time, J.D. Vance. The families you're tearing apart certainly won't." The vice president wrote back, "Had a great time, thanks." And from the July-August issue of Vanity Fair, Allison Janney answers the Proust questionnaire. Her first question, "What's your idea of perfect happiness?" "Dance music, incredible food, great friends, and lots of dogs." "What's your greatest fear?" "Being boring. I've had two therapists fall asleep on me. Not kidding. Are people even reading this far?" "Which living person do you most admire?" "My niece, Petra Janney, who got her pilot's license to rescue animals from rural kill shelters and have them placed with different pet adoption agencies." "What is the trait you most deplore in yourself?" "Oh, I have a long list. You should have asked me what I like about myself. That list is much shorter." "What's the trait you most deplore in others?" "People who punch down." "What is your greatest extravagance?" "Postmates." "What's your favorite journey?" "Coming home after being away for a chunk of time." "What do you consider the most overrated virtue?" "Self-control. I would rather not elaborate." "On what occasion do you lie?" "Always to spare someone's feelings, especially my own." "What do you dislike most about your appearance?" "I would love it if I was just a few inches taller." That is a joke. Which living person do you most despise? Three guesses, and the first two don't count. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? I say, I don't know, a lot, which drives me crazy. What is your greatest regret? Not throwing more caution to the wind. Which talent would you most like to have? I have this fantasy that I'm playing lead guitar in a band in some obscure bar, and I'm killing it. What is your current state of mind? Politically apprehensive, yet personally cautiously optimistic. What, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I wish I always had the right word in the right moment at the right time and not 2 hours later in my car going home. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Having a career in this crazy business. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I'd want to come back as a better version of myself, if that's even possible, ha ha ha. What is your most treasured possession? The photographs my uncle, Michael Putnam, took of my family. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Wanting something for someone you love more than they want it for themselves. I lost my brother to addiction. Where would you like to live? London, maybe Hampstead Heath. What's your favorite occupation? Well, before I could call myself a working actress, when asked what I did, I would say I was a photographer. I still think that's a cool occupation. What is your most marked characteristic? My voice. What do you most value in your friends? A sense of humor, honesty, and trust. Who are your heroes in real life? Firemen, philanthropists, and first responders. What are your favorite names? I spend a lot of time thinking up dog names. Currently, I love Ocho, Paco, and Gary. What is it that you most dislike? Dishonesty, controlling people, and anchovies. How would you like to die? I do not like to think about that, but I could tell you how I would not like to die. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week, everybody.